Hi, I'm Brett Snyder, and I'm the author of Cranky Flyer.
Hi, I'm Brian Summers, and I write The Airline Observer.
Hi, I'm John Ostrower, editor-in-chief of The Air Current. You're listening to The Air Show, the podcast where we talk about what goes on in the business of the sky.
Today, we're going to talk about Boeing, and we're pretty lucky here. We have, among our co-hosts, the world's most important reporter who covers Boeing. He's going to walk us through it.
Yes, I am. Oh, you didn't mean me, did you? Just
wanders in from behind the curtain.
It's you, Ostrower.
Oh.
I don't know what the hell is happening here.
Oh, God. I haven't slept in 3 days. And that is half a function of one of the world's largest commercial aircraft manufacturers and a certain five-year-old who doesn't want to sleep. So the combination together is going to create a very interesting episode for you. But it is the episode where we're going to talk about Boeing. And we're going to talk about what has gone on with the company in just the last several days with major leadership changes at their commercial business, at the chairmanship of the board, and upcoming with the CEO as they begin a search for a new chief executive. And there is a lot to unpack. And so we're going to really break this discussion up into two major parts. There's what the heck just happened, and more importantly, where do we as an industry go from here? So do you guys want to ask, like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. That's my next part in the script. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Okay, excellent.
All right, this sounds good, John. So let's start in that first part of what the hell just happened?
Well, Boeing is in the middle of what is probably the single biggest strategic leadership change in the last 25 years. Over the weekend, the board of directors, responding to a report in the Wall Street Journal that airlines had requested meetings not directly with the leadership of the company, but with the board of directors, absent the CEO, Dave Calhoun. And that was a moment where the board stepped back and reflected on where things were. And it kicked off first a decision to fire Stan Deal, who was the head of Boeing's commercial business, a 38-year veteran of the company, and also then triggered Dave Calhoun, who's been CEO since January of 2020, to decide to actually not step down, but initiate his retirement at the end of the year, which will kick off a CEO search. In conjunction with Dave Calhoun deciding to step down and retire at the end of the year, the chairman of the board, Larry Kellner, the former CEO of Continental Airlines, who ascended the chairmanship when Calhoun became CEO in 2020, decided to not seek re-election to the board of directors at the shareholder meeting in May. To have the departure of all of those three positions, or the planned departure of those three positions simultaneously, represents a seismic shift in potentially the direction of the company. And I think I say potentially because the airline universe and the supplier universe and the ecosystem of organizations and stakeholders and government and labor and the capital markets that rely on Boeing will have a chance to see whether or not this represents a start of a new direction for the company. And over the remainder of the year, we're going to see this CEO search take place that will set the stage for that.
I want to back up for a second here. You mentioned the Wall Street Journal report, but is that why this happened now? I mean, how long have we been hearing complaints about Boeing's leadership? Probably from the day Calhoun started, the fact that he was already an insider.
So some background here. So on Tuesday afternoon, The Air Current published a lengthy account of what went on over the weekend and what led up to the departure or planned departure of these three leaders at Boeing. And what we learned was that the decision to seek these meetings by the airline CEOs, and by the way, we were able to report that it was specifically American's Robert Isom, it was Alaska's Ben Minicucci, United's Scott Kirby, and Southwest's Bob Jordan. Four of the most strategic customers and the biggest Boeing operators in the U.S. To seek those meetings directly. And it wasn't a happenstance that they requested this. So what we found out was that On March 7th, at the Airlines for America board meeting, the airline CEOs put their heads together and decided to figure out a way to communicate to Boeing's leadership and Boeing's board that they wanted to understand and be reassured of the direction of the company. And they wanted to hear it from the board members, not the CEO. I don't believe in, and all evidence points in this direction, that they were trying to force a leadership change at the company. I think what they were trying to do was get transparency and clarity about where things were going and whether or not they could support the future direction of the company. However, in asking for those meetings, absent CEO Dave Calhoun, it became a symbolic vote of no confidence. Because, you know, to quote one, you know, senior industry official that was knowledgeable about how this all went down, quote, they didn't want to get the defensive bull. They wanted to hear it directly through them and not filtered through Calhoun and Boeing Commercial Airplanes CEO Stan Deal. And so that really sets the stage. That moment of saying there is a filter in between the board and the most important part of Boeing in terms of revenue generation, the customers, they didn't feel like they were having a complete conversation, that they were looking through a soda straw and being given a soda straw view of the world. And this was an opportunity to change that.
Okay. So hold on though. Hold on. This meeting never happened, right?
No, the meeting never happened.
It was just the request that triggered it.
And the meetings are going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
This is the level of frustration they're at where they've basically decided that their last chance is we need to hope that the board will understand how bad these problems are. Like, this seems like an extraordinary move.
It is. It absolutely is. And when you think about it from the perspective of they set up a meeting in D.C. at the A4A board meeting to talk about how they were going to address this, that tells you exactly what level to which this rises. I mean, these are four airlines that operate, doing the quick math in my head, like 2,000 Boeing airplanes, something like that. I mean, it's a huge, huge, huge number.
John, do you have a sense for which U.S. airline CEO was leading the charge here? I mean, I doubt the four of them equally came to this idea. It must have been one of their ideas, right?
Well, I think, you know, you just look at a lot of the public statements over the last 3 months since Alaska Airlines 1282. And Scott Kirby at United has obviously been the most vocal, having gone on CNBC and effectively delivered a public vote of no confidence in Boeing's leadership. And he stopped short of calling for explicit change, but it was what was not said in his comments, where he said, you know, we support and full confidence in the people of Boeing. Well, if he was going to give Dave Calhoun and Stan Deal a vote of confidence, that was going to be his moment. Certainly, United Next and the trajectory of United Next hangs in the balance here. And absent the MAX 10, which is obviously a casualty of the regulatory scrutiny, and Boeing's decision on the MAX 7, which, by the way, Southwest is waiting for, to have to redo the anti-ice system in the engine to meet certification compliance, which pushes everything down the road, which, again, was a function of Boeing's inability to go to the FAA and ask for an exemption that was anything related to safety, given what had just unfolded. So their businesses were hanging in the balance. Their ability to grow and their ability to plan.
See, I think this is so important because, you know, everything that gets reported, I mean, my God, everything's a Boeing airplane in the news now, even if it's unrelated to anything Boeing did, right? Like, they've got that heightened sensitivity, and the FAA has had a heightened sensitivity since the MAX is the first accident. I mean, this has been going on for years, and I think it really says something. I mean, this is kind of insane that the MAX 7 can't be certified because of the anti-ice issue when the MAX 8 is and 9 are flying with this same issue and they're totally fine with that, right? I mean, this is more of a PR issue. It's the fact that Boeing has just done this to itself. It's not specifically this is a horribly concerning safety issue because there are still thousands of planes flying with it.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, which is that this is not about Alaska Airlines 1282. This is the sedimentary layers of a lot of really bad things layered on top of each other over the course of the last 15 or 20 years. And there's a lot of bad blood that has been created. And Boeing does not have a lot of public defenders. Very few, in fact, in terms of how they've conducted their business.
I mean, who's a public defender? I can't say I've heard any.
I mean, I think what you've heard is defenders of the institution, not defenders of the leadership. And I think that's an important distinction. But fundamentally, and I think this is really, really, really important, everything that's happened in the media, quote unquote, the media is not a monolith, right? But it tends to fly in formation sometimes, right? The media frenzy that has ensued since 1282 was fundamentally a function of the mistrust that had been built up after all of these events over the last 5 and 10 years. So when it comes time for reporting to happen on a broken windshield or a lost tire, people completely lose proportion. And it's not that they're non-stories. Most are non-stories and totally disconnected and separate from any kind of common thread. But the common thread here is that the airline customers were getting sucked into the black hole of mistrust, that they were getting assigned the responsibility for how the public and the regulators and Congress and customers were feeling about Boeing. And that's the context for why the media landscape got as crazy as it did over the last several months. And so you take that, and a CEO who was chairman of the board, and before that was on the board since 2009, becoming CEO in the midst of that, there was a sense, certainly amongst the customers and the suppliers and of course amongst the families of the victims of those two plane crashes, that a person who was at the helm or part of the decision making that led to how the company was conducting its business would become CEO, effectively becoming elevated to the top job in the middle of this. And so there was a tremendous amount of frustration and real, resentment is the wrong word, but there's real deep wounds that have not had a chance to heal because of how this has played out. And you know, Boeing went on a tour, you know, afterwards making changes to its engineering universe and its safety structure and all that. And, you know, the chief safety officer said, well, there are still people within Boeing who you know, haven't really totally come to terms with Boeing's role in those two crashes, i.e. designing the MCAS system that caused the airplanes to ultimately lose control. And that there was sense that there was still a lot of blame for the pilots. And the reality is chief amongst them was Boeing CEO himself. And there were things that the comments that he made in 2020 around that, after he took over, number one, simultaneously blaming the problems of the company on the past leadership from which he was a part, but also effectively saying, you know, if the pilots had been from a different region of the world, i.e. the US or Europe, this would not have happened.
Yeah, John, I just want to say, you know, Dave Calhoun has been such a disaster as CEO for all of the reasons that you talk about. You know, they haven't made great airplanes, they haven't delivered airplanes on time. But one thing that I've noticed and I've heard from these airlines is he has just been a horrible communicator. So maybe if all this stuff had happened, but he was still able to say the right things at the right time and not be so defensive and angry and not be so bad on CNBC and not use that ridiculous phrase, quality escape, you know, maybe this would have gone a lot better for him. You know, I've heard, and Brett, you've probably heard as well, from, you know, airline leaders who say, we can't get him on the phone. He doesn't call us. We have to try to figure out what's going on our own. John, do you hear anything about, you know, this lack of communication? And is there an understanding at Boeing that these people have to learn how to communicate?
I think it's an issue of the intersection of words and actions, right? It's the ability to say one thing and then seemingly do another. And this is something I've seen through the thread of Boeing CEOs over the last 15 years, where they will say, oh, you know, we're not doing this, where, you know, it's you know, we're not going to ask the suppliers for 15% of their margin, and it's that or else, and we really want to work together in a win-win. And then no, that they spend the next 10 years doing exactly that. And I think it's really interesting to look at this over time, where amazingly Dave Calhoun is a much better communicator than Dennis Muilenburg, his predecessor. That's how bad of a communicator Dennis Muilenburg was. I mean, he's an engineer. He is a brilliant guy and understood how the company operated and was able to communicate that. But when it came to the level of necessary contrition and empathy that was required of a leader in the middle of the grounding in 2019 and 2020, it fell far short. Just far short. So Dave Calhoun coming in and coming with a much more candid, publicly much more candid approach and a much less scripted, it drove the communications handlers nuts. It's like, Dave, can you just stop talking at times? And he would get himself in trouble. You know, he threatened to cancel the Max 10 at one point if he didn't get a congressional exemption. There were things that, tell the New York Times, like, okay, I'll tell you whether or not the pilots were responsible. I believe the pilots were responsible for the crashes, but can you turn off your recorder first? There's a lot of this. And he's very candid and he's very unfiltered in that way. In an environment where you can, set your watch to the Boeing messaging, word choice for years around how they would message things, that level of lack of discipline was really, really unsettling for many. Getting back to the key point, right? I mean, just about airlines' ability to communicate with them. They did not hear from him. Over the last 4 years, I have heard from many airline customers who said they communicated with Stan Deal in the commercial business because when they either requested meetings or expected some outreach from the C-suite, it never came. And I think there was a hands-off view of how Calhoun viewed the role of the corporate business sitting above both the defense and commercial and services units of the company, where a lot of what he did was to push a lot of those decisions and actions back down to the business units. He got rid of the strategy function at corporate, which many saw that as a unilateral disarmament for the direction of the company, which I think is fair. But he also saw a lot of the things that were going on around corporate as sort of the artifice of centralization, where you just have a CEO who just has these functions around him and they aren't really doing anything and they're expensive and they're not really making decisions. So he was trying to push that back. But however, when it comes to communicating in a crisis, that's not one of those things that you want to be leaning on. Yes, you want to let the commercial business do their work, let the defense business do their work, let them interface with the customers, but who is running the Boeing company?
All right. So look, I mean, there will be many more stories to be written here. Hopefully you can get some sleep before the next one. But we need to talk about what this means going forward. There were people who were skeptical about Dave Calhoun when he took the job. Now everyone appears to be on the same page. So where do we go from here? And we're going to talk about all that. But first, a word from our sponsors, starting with PlusGrade. I have a question here. Who buys points? Have you ever done this, Brian?
I have, Brett. I buy a lot of frequent flyer miles, most recently through Avianca Life Miles. I think I have hundreds of thousands of these points. They're actually a pretty good deal, and they're very, very easy to buy.
I don't doubt that, but why are you doing this?
Well, again, it's a pretty good deal. I'm getting a business class at a very reduced rate, and I enjoy flying.
All right. It sounds like you're not alone. People have been using PlusGrade for 2 decades. They took over Points, the company, in 2022, which was a leader in loyalty commerce.
Yeah, PlusGrade told us that this really works. They told us that loyalty program members who purchase points complete 31% more transactions in the airline as a whole. They buy 26% more flights. And most importantly, they redeem more than double the miles. And as an avid purchaser of Life Miles, I can tell you, Brett, that's pretty much true.
PlusGrade are the experts in running Buy Miles programs. Reach out to them to get yours started or make your existing program drive even more revenue. Brian, we need to talk a little bit more about Intelsat.
Yeah, Brett, in the past, I've just wanted to know, is the internet going to work? But I think you know more than I do about the antenna itself. What makes the technology here different that Intelsat is using?
The little teeny tiny antenna, the little 3-inch cap. So look, here's the thing about it. It uses both satellites in low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit. These are different things. One is close to the Earth. That's the low Earth. The beauty of low Earth orbit is that it has really low latency, so there's not a lot of delay when you're going back and forth, and it's really nice and it's fast and powerful. Geosynchronous, though, can cover a broader area, and generally you have more power in one satellite kind of thing. But when you combine them, it means that Intelsat can have coverage all over the globe with its one little antenna. And, you know, wherever you are flying, you will have access.
And remind me, Brett, what airlines are going to be using this?
Well, we have Aerolíneas Argentinas, of course, but we also have Alaska, Air Canada, and American.
Staying connected anytime, anywhere is more important than ever. Intelsat leads the way with a multi-orbit network, an industry-leading antenna technology that delivers nonstop in-flight connectivity everywhere airlines fly. All right, so in the first half of the show, we learned about how U.S. Airlines helped force out the CEO of Boeing, not until the end of the year, of course, and the CEO of Boeing Commercial Airplanes much sooner. He's retiring. Now we want to know what's going to be happening for Boeing going forward. And I think the question on everybody's mind, John, is who are the leading contenders to be the next CEO, and what do these people need to know about possibly taking over this company?
This is going to decide the future of Boeing for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. In announcing his retirement at the end of the year, it effectively kicked off a discussion about who would be best for this role. The names that are talked about most are folks like this current CEO of Spirit AeroSystems, Pat Shanahan, who is a longtime Boeing executive, who was head of airplane programs, ran the 787 program, ran the 757 program. He was in the 777 program for earlier in his career, ran rotorcraft, knows the defense business, and has a huge breadth of experience at Boeing. He left in 2017 to be Deputy Secretary of Defense for the Trump administration and was actually in line to become Secretary of Defense after James Mattis retired. The other most likely contender for the top spot at Boeing is currently the chairman of American Airlines, Greg Smith, who is Boeing's former CFO. Spent a long time with the company reorganizing its production system and the company's financial performance around that. He also notably was chief financial officer under Jim McNerney and Dennis Muilenburg at a time when the company was actively engaging in a campaign to wring margin from the supply chain and right the financial ship of the 787 development. And so all that is happening as Boeing stock is soaring and they're buying back shares at the $300 and $400 level. So there's a really two competing visions here in terms of the levels of experience that are on the table for Boeing insiders to take over and take the reins of this company going forward. Should Boeing be the financial performer that it has been eventually? Yes, that's the goal. It's a publicly traded company. But in terms of what you're optimizing for and the teams that you assemble and build to implement those strategies, which, by the way, include, number one, reintegration of Spirit AeroSystems, where Pat Shanahan is currently the CEO. Number two, getting the airplane production system back on track first and foremost. And then also how you begin to put the defense business back together and restore not just customer trust, but employee trust. There have been really deep rifts created, not just with suppliers and airlines, but with the employees themselves. And a lot of that was a function of how Boeing conducted itself around labor relations and how it saw both its engineering workforce and its machinists and really driving a direct rift during the years when, you know, Jim McNerney was CEO and obviously Craig Smith was his CFO and through his tenure as Dennis Muilenburg CFO as well. And so there are dueling visions here, I think, for where things go. I think they both want the best for Boeing, and they want it to be healthy, and they want it to be reliably delivering high-quality airplanes safely. That's baseline, by the way. That's if you don't have that as your expectation, you're in trouble.
Yeah, this shouldn't be a goal.
No, exactly, right? But they have to get back there first before they can even have that discussion. And so it's a question of the belief that you have to tell Wall Street to take a walk for several years. you are not going to get the returns that you've been promised for some time, because the golden goose that you expect is not healthy right now. And it's not going to be healthy if you optimize for trying to generate shareholder returns. There is a lot of work that Boeing has to do on itself before it can really even compete with Airbus on a level playing field and then deliver the financial returns that come from that.
Well, that seems like something that would be harder to do if you're putting the former CFO in place to say, don't pay attention to Wall Street. But I'm curious on this. These two are both Boeing people. Is there an argument to be made for going with a true outsider? Or is it? Do you need the internal knowledge to run Boeing?
Boeing culturally right now is a very challenged place. And I think any outsider would need to be so strong in terms of being an architect of the organization to not be eaten alive by that culture, which is, by the way, not healthy at the moment. And it's within the executive ranks and management. And I hear a bit about it all the time in terms of the short-term nature of decision-making and concerns around how they carry on in their business. And we saw this recorded and documented in a report from that was congressionally mandated by a group of 24 experts in academia, in Boeing's peers, customers, that detailed sort of the disconnect in the safety culture from the words, again, that were coming from the C-suite and how it was being perceived on the factory floor and in the engineering ranks. And so that's the culture that has to be dismantled and rebuilt. And to rebuild that requires, again, someone with a very clear picture about what needs to happen. And this is a phenomenally, phenomenally complex organization. And I don't think there is time for someone to have to be on a learning curve for how to run Boeing.
John, everything you've said has told us that Boeing, especially on the commercial side, is a very wounded company. But it's still part of a duopoly with Airbus, right? It's still, you know, number two in aircraft production. Do you have any sense, are we going to stick with this duopoly, or is there a chance that a third manufacturer can use this time and really get in there and make sure that we have three real options of aircraft providers?
Well, the last time we had three real providers was when McDonnell Douglas was doing business in the 90s. And they were not doing great during those years and really ultimately on the trajectory toward getting bought by Boeing again. The duopoly itself is a stable way to deliver airplanes when it's balanced and it's healthy. Right now, it's not balanced and it's not healthy. And I think what that does is it does create the opportunity for people to think about different strategies for how you be a large commercial aircraft manufacturer. And let's just say the obvious part up front. Bombardier is not a manufacturer of commercial aircraft anymore because they challenged this duopoly and lost badly. And it forced them out of the industry at the commercial aircraft level. And the A220 is an Airbus product and not a Bombardier product. And so you take that and you say, well, what are the barriers to entry to challenge these two and have those changed? Well, the barriers on how much it costs, like literally just the dollar amount to get in the business, is absolutely astronomical, unimaginable. So either you need a sovereign wealth fund to back you, or you need an existing player. And we have the rise of China right now, and we have COMAC. And I think over time, when they get their rhythm on production, I think we're going to start to see export markets for the COMAC products that are going to happen in places like Southeast Asia and Africa that will begin to lay that foundation. I think that's going to be a slow process. There's really only one entity that can assume a role of not necessarily as replacing Boeing in the duopoly, but joining the duopoly, making it a triopoly, and that's Embraer. And they right now have a strategy of saying, hey, we just did the E2, we just did the KC-390 transport, we just did a bunch of business jets. We're gonna go ahead and harvest that investment with a gigantic however attached to that. In the conversations that I've had with their CEO recently, said 2025 rolls around, we're going to be making some decisions about what we want to do. the strategic landscape is and has changed in terms of customer embrace of a new entrant. And a step up from where Embraer is on the large, either large regionals or small narrow bodies, whatever you want to call them, that allows them technically and industrially the capability to make that leap if they want to, but they have to decide to do it. And having the existing infrastructure and experience, and as an organization is technically incredibly excellent. And that's part of why Boeing wanted to acquire 80% of their commercial business back in 2018. And so they have that option in front of them. They have to decide to do it, though. And it's not an easy thing to do. And you probably need, again, sovereign backing, whether it's the Brazilian government or another government, to effectively backstop their ascent if they decide to do it. But the opportunity is there if they want it. The customers want a choice.
There's so much more we could talk about, guys, about Boeing, but we've got to leave it somewhere. And it's here. This won't be the last time we talk about Boeing, of course, as long as John is one of our co-hosts. You can read his reporting at The Air Current. And you've been listening to The Air Show.
If you have suggestions or questions for us, or you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, go to our website, theairshowpodcast.com, to get in touch.
Thanks to PlusGrade and IntelSat for sponsoring the show. The Air Show podcast is produced and edited by Sarah Fay. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosier. I'm Brett Snyder.
I'm Brian Summers.
And I'm John Ostrower. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.